through the Son of the Holy Spirit. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Seed of wisdom, in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Greetings from Fatima. It was a memorable experience, and maybe sometime I could give the lectures. I gave 5 lectures there at Fatima. As I was telling Carolyn and Kathleen, I spent 9 days in Fatima. I had never been there before, and had deep faith of the people. At the weekend, about 10,000 people came, because this is also already after the 13th and 15th of August. I got there on the 16th, but Fatima itself, the city, is some distance away from what is now called Fatima. It's really maybe the 5 miles from the city where the apparitions took place. But everything now is called Fatima. And they have a bishop there, the bishop of Fatima. And confessions from 7:30 in the morning and 7:30 at night. And so I heard my share of confessions too. And then had a public mass in English, and stayed at a place called Domus Pacis. Is that your place in Washington, Domus Pacis? House of Peace? What is it called?
Gift of Peace.
Or Gift of Peace. Or Donum. Donum Pacis. And one of the encouraging things is the number of communities. About 64 communities are now in Fatima, and from all over the world, and they're getting vocations. In fact, one girl who was on the pilgrimage that I was involved in, she was born in Korea, but she's family lives in Seattle, Washington, and well, we talked, because part of my job is to give counsel to the people, you see. So we had a schedule and a time when I was meet with them, and well, graces, extraordinary graces were given during those days there. So her name is, keep her in your prayers, Cecilia Lee. Yeah, she pronounces Lee, L-E-A. But she wanted to be a contemplative, so they're contemplative sisters, different communities, one that I know because I directed another girl from Washington to join that community. Yes, the Sisters of St. Dominic of the Perpetual Rosary. And they have exposition 24 hours a day, and they keep reciting the rosary 24 hours a day. They're an Irish community, I mean, have Irish background. So I said mass for the sisters, and then Cecilia Lee, she stayed in Fatima. She's going to be there for 2 more weeks. She got her ticket changed. They told her to stay for 2 weeks and come and see. And of course, they would also give a look. And then come back to the States, and she makes plans to come back to Fatima to become a member of that community. So their vocations, people that discover their vocations, and the most significant member of the pilgrimage was Michael Cafferty. He's not Polish. Three years ago, he was in an automobile accident. He survived the accident, so he's alive, but his spinal cord was broken, so he's completely paralyzed from the neck down. Completely. Can't move a muscle, not even his fingers, nothing. So he's in a wheelchair, and he got no mic, and we had a number of meetings together, and he's going to college, and he's from Illinois, so the state of Illinois will pay for his education, but he'll be waited on every minute for everything. So then on the way back from Fatima on the bus, an hour and a half drive from Fatima to Lisbon to the airport, he got a microphone and gave a speech thanking everybody for how kind they were and how much he learned about Christian charity. So one of the pilgrims, as they might call them, it was a Janice Lee, also Lee. She spells her name L-E-E from New Jersey. By the way, she knows your sisters well. In fact, your sisters kind of helped her to fix up her life. So she's a volunteer, you know, with your sisters in New Jersey. And Janice came to the retreat that I gave Mary Ann Caddy in West Virginia before I came back to Detroit to leave for Fatima. And so she thought she should go to Fatima, but she wasn't sure what she was going to do. I said, "Oh, that's simple. You be my secretary. I'm going to write a book on Fatima." So it's about half finished. And so about 3 to 4 hours every day, she took a dictation, and then on the plane back from Portugal, I got a seat next to her. So for 4 hours, she was taking dictation on the plane. I told Kathleen and Carolyn, I asked if she was sleepy, tired. Well, she said no, so that settled it. But then for about an hour, there was one fellow that wanted to talk, so I had him change places with her, so he and I could talk on the plane while she went to his seat. And then when I went back to retrieve her, she was sleeping. At any rate, so we got some work done. And then I could talk longer, but it was a very fascinating experience. In our class today, we'll be on St. Augustine. You know why, don't you? Whose feast is tomorrow? St. Augustine. So, and I had just enough time to photograph the first 30 questions. So, if you would return those that are left over, so one to a customer. There were, of course, 100 questions, but What I thought we would do, that came in Sunday night, and then yesterday I had to catch up partly on sleep because it wasn't too much sleep at Fatima. I was up till usually midnight each night, and we had early mass. So we will have our class on St. Augustine. Now today is the 27th. Next week I will be on retreat. I'm going into my own retreat this Friday night. And unless I'm mistaken, it'll be all week. My retreat begins on, well, the evening of the 30th, and we finish on the morning of the 8th. Now, what day of the week is the 8th of September?
Sunday.
Sunday is the 8th. Well, and all next week I'll be out of circulation, and that's the idea. So there'll be no class next week. Now the week after, if I come out on the morning of the 8th, you see that's Sunday, eh? Well, then I'm home the 9th, and 10th is Tuesday, isn't it?
Yes.
But I'm giving a women's retreat in Chicago, 10th, 11th, and 12th, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Now, Tuesday, so I'm supposed to start the women's retreat in Chicago. So, I have to figure that out. Now, may I ask you, we could then have class either on Monday of the 9th, or when I come back from the retreat in Chicago, which would be the 12th, I'm home the 13th, which I think is a Friday. Is that correct? I know I'm giving a talk that evening at Ann Arbor, second Friday of the month. So either the 9th, which is a Monday, maybe Tuesday, but I don't want to take a chance on missing the flight for start the retreat in the evening. So either Monday or Friday.
Monday
would be better, if you could. The 9th of September. Okay. So that will be our next class then. Then we'll get going. Now we're going to have a St. Augustine.
Okay. Could you hold the microphone?
Could I hold the microphone? I don't hold the microphone.
Now, the present class, we call it such, is on St. Augustine and based on the Book of the Confessions of St. Augustine. Today is the feast of his mother, St. Monica, and tomorrow of her son.
What I'd like to do then today is to give you an overview of St. Augustine, and then your quiz,
30 questions. By the way, think those questions out. They are not obvious. This is from, the book that goes along with the course. St. Augustine is one of the greatest minds of the Catholic Church. I consider him the greatest mind since St. Paul. As you know, he lived in the late 4th and early part of the 5th century. And he wrote many books, of which the two most important are The City of God and His Confessions. What I will do then today is say something about his book, The Confessions, and then analyze St. Augustine. No writer outside of the sacred scriptures has spoken more eloquently about man's desire for happiness than St. Augustine. Among his many books is one on the happy life, De Vita Beata. Augustine then may be described as the one who gave us the most complete theological explanation of what is true happiness. Happiness comes from satisfying the will. All unhappiness is unsatisfied desires. In fact, that's St. Augustine's definition that I've been using ever since. Unhappiness is unsatisfied desires. When a child is born, mothers tell me, they cannot express their desires, but they manifest them in other ways. They're hungry. They desire food. The opening paragraph of St. Augustine's Confessions is also not just St. Augustine's, but our own profession of faith. And let me read the paragraph. You are great, O Lord, and greatly to be praised. Great is your power, and to your wisdom there is no limit. And man, who is a part of your creation, wishes to praise you. Man who bears about within himself his mortality, who bears within himself testimony to his sin and testimony that you resist the proud. Yet man, this part of your creation, wishes to praise you. You arouse him to take joy in praising you, for you have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests in you. So our heart is restless, hungry for happiness. A good definition of man. The creature who is hungry for happiness. The only question is, how can that hunger be satisfied? And Augustine found out after years of wandering away from God that no creature can satisfy man. Only God. And God will satisfy us, Him on earth, on one condition, that we do not seek our own will, but the will of God. All unhappiness, Augustine would say, is due to the fact that people are looking for happiness, starving for happiness, but they're looking for it in the wrong place. They're looking for happiness in satisfying their own will. That's the opening paragraph of St. Augustine. Over the years I've taught the theology of St. Augustine, but I might bring some of my notes on St. Augustine. Well, I may share some of them with you. But St. Augustine is an ocean. What I thought we would do is first say something about the importance of St. Augustine, and then talk a little bit about the significance of Augustine living when he did. When the Roman Empire was coming to an end, first, then, the importance of St. Augustine. There is nobody, but nobody, in Catholic literature, always outside the scriptures, that compares for importance with St. Augustine. Nobody. He is the most important figure in all of Catholic literature. His writings cover the whole span of our faith, theology, philosophy, morality, spirituality, and indeed a great deal of Catholic thinking since his day has been shaped by St. Augustine. There are many definitions of the faith which are taken verbatim from St. Augustine. We may say there are especially three reasons for St. Augustine's greatness, always as a writer. First, his unqualified orthodoxy. Augustine was a Catholic. Secondly, his deep understanding of the mysteries of the faith. And thirdly, the beauty and the clarity of his writing. First, then, something about his orthodoxy. As I've said before, St. Augustine is almost a standard of orthodoxy. There is no single writer whose writings have been quoted more often by the Church, more often in the Divine Office, more often in one council of the Church after another. The one author, after the scriptures always, most quoted by Vatican II, is St. Augustine. He died in 430 A.D. Within 1 year of his death, Pope St. Celestine I declared that Augustine was among the outstanding teachers of sacred doctrine. As you know, in those days they did not have what we now have, formal canonization of saints. Canonization of saints did not begin until the 11th century. For the first 1,000 years of the church's history, outstanding persons, men, women, and children, martyrs, of course, but others too, who were outstanding for their holiness, had their sanctity recognized, first by the local bishop in the diocese where they lived and died, and then as the veneration spread from one diocese to another, they became our saints. St. Augustine was never formally canonized, but neither was St. Augustine, neither was St. Patrick, St. Boniface, St. Benedict, St. Basil. Thousands of saints, many of whose feasts we celebrate in the Universal Liturgy of the Church, have never been canonized. You might see Augustine as canonized almost the day that he died, because his writing was so totally orthodox. One pope after another, one general council after another, have relied on St. Augustine's authority to explain or defend what we are to believe. I counted the number of times that St. Augustine is either directly or indirectly quoted in Vatican II. I counted 40 times. In any case, Augustine's orthodoxy is unimpeachable. Now, around the subject of orthodoxy, St. Augustine was one of the great champions of papal authority. Among many statements that he made, which are quotable, St. Augustine is very quotable, that if I read something in Scripture and I decide this is what it means, but I found out that what I have been saying or writing is not supported by the Pope, then I must be wrong. Before he died, St. Augustine, unique among the great writers of the Church's sacred doctrine, wrote a whole book called Retractationes, Retractations, in other words, statements that he made which some people were quoting and getting, well, a wrong interpretation, or where he thought he had made a mistake. He wrote a whole volume of about 400 pages of corrections of his writings. It is well to know that St. Augustine lived during the period of three of the worst heresies in the Church's history, namely Donatism, Pelagianism, and Manichaeism. Donatism, D-O-N-A-T-I-S-M, sometimes pronounced Donatism. Donatism was the heresy which claimed that. A person's sanctity determines his continued membership in the church. In other words, the church is, as we recite in the Apostles' Creed, a communion of saints. If you're not a saint, if you're not in God's friendship, well, you may have been a member of the church, but sorry, my dear, you no longer are. Now, this caused a major convulsion, especially in North Africa, where during the persecution of the church, many people apostatized. Then, when the persecution let up, they were repentant and wanted to come back, well, into full communion with the church. They were being told by one bishop after another, you must be rebaptized because you've lost, well, you're not just sanctifying grace, you've lost your, you know, charism of baptism. And priests, so the heresy claimed, priests who were not in the state of grace could not validly offer Mass or consecrate or absolve from sins in the sacrament of confession. Bishops who were unholy, they could not ordain priests or other bishops. Augustine fought the Donatists and clarified so many things that we now take for granted. That the church is not only a church of holy people, and that the sacraments are validly administered even by a bishop or priest who is not in the state of grace. All of this Augustine wrote, defended, and Augustine's teaching became then part of the church's official doctrine. The second great heresy was Pelagianism. Pelagius, remember, was a monk from Great Britain. The only major heretic that the British can claim. Most of the heretics were from the Near East. But the British have one big heretic, Pelagius. He was a monk. Made the mistake of traveling out of his monastery. And the more he traveled, the more he was scandalized at the behavior of unholy bishops, unholy priests, and unholy religious. So Pelagius figured out, this is the reason the Catholic Church has been making a mistake. She's been saying that what we need is God's grace to be holy. Said Pelagius, no, what we need to be holy is willpower. Is on the spinal cord. If you've got a strong will, you'll become holy. It is not God's grace that makes a person holy. It is our willpower. And Pelagius was very ascetic. He lived on a starvation diet. He slept very little. He looked like a saint, but he was a heretic. By the way, beware of saintly looking heretics. They're the most dangerous. Augustine at first couldn't believe that Pelagius was in his right mind. because Augustine for 33 years, as we know, had lived a life of sin. And he knew he shouldn't be behaving the way he was behaving, but as on one dramatic occasion he told the Lord, "Lord, any time you want to make me holy, I'm at your disposal." Because I can't do it. So when Pelagius began teaching, once Augustine found out that Pelagius was serious, I would say the single subject on which Augustine wrote most of his books are called the Anti-Pelagian Writings against Pelagius. One of his most famous books is On Grace and Free Will, in which Augustine showed and his teaching on divine grace has made him, and the name that the church gives him, there are at least half a dozen famous names that St. Augustine has. One of them is Doctor Gratiae, the teacher of grace. Now Augustine, writing in the heat of the Pelagian controversy, said some very strong things against the Pelagians, which then in the 16th century the Protestants came along and picked up, quoting St. Augustine out of context. To prove to their satisfaction that Augustine was on their side. See, everybody wants to quote Augustine. In the principal work of John Calvin, the great evil genius of the Protestant Reformation, I counted the number of times that John Calvin quotes St. Augustine. Direct words from St. Augustine. I counted over 800 quotations. Remember the name of Jansenius, the heretical bishop? Could anybody remember the name of the diocese where Jansenius was bishop? I'm sure somewhere it begins with a Y. Ypres. Yeah. I was going to ask you to finish the sentence. The capacity of your mind to forget is, remember? What is it?
Infinite.
The infinite. Thanks, Carolyn. Well, these are the satisfactions. There are little joys that a teacher has when the students remember what they were taught. Ypres, Y-P-R-E-S. Now Jansenius wrote only one book in his life. That was plenty. And he called the book Augustine. The whole book is full of heresy. Every page at least a half a dozen heresies. But the whole book is an alleged commentary on St. Augustine. That for 1600 years the Catholic Church, well, quite 1200 years, had misunderstood St. Augustine. And he, the great Jansenius, finally understood St. Augustine. And all that Jansenius was doing was copying from John Calvin, not even giving Calvin credit. So that's the second great heresy where St. Augustine's orthodoxy, we're talking about orthodoxy, remember? Where his orthodoxy was especially important, is a mild word, indispensable to preserve the church. See, all the great heresies come from intelligent people. Bishop McBride, Notre Dame, he's an amateur. He's not really intelligent. Hans Kuhn is an amateur. I put him maybe at most fourth or fifth grade of grammar school for his knowledge of theology. A mere child. Oh, but Skillebex. Or Runner. They have intelligence. So God raised up the genius of Augustine to cope with the geniuses that were denying the faith. That, by the way, will be the theme of the book, the Lord willing, I'll publish on my memoirs of Fatima. Our Lady was asking for conversions. 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 Well, what I learned at Fatima, the most important converts we've got to make is among the intellectuals. Because the hardest people to convert are proud people. Adulterers you can convert. Prostitutes you can convert. Homosexuals you can convert. Thieves, the mafia people, you can convert. But you just try to convert a heretical theologian. It's like raising Lazarus from the dead. I know. How will I know? So Augustine then fought the Pelagians and gave the Catholic Church, I would say, all the basic teaching on the necessity of divine grace for salvation. The third major heresy that God raised Augustine to combat was Manichaeism. Now Manichaeism takes his name from Manichaeus, living in what we now call the Near East. He was the opposite of Pelagius. From Manichaeus, where for Pelagius there is no grace, from Manichaeus that's all there is grace. There's no free will. Who remembers what St. Augustine professed for 9 years before his conversion? He was a Manichaean. It was a very convenient heresy. By the way, all heresies are convenient. That's where they come into existence. People want to believe certain things or behave in a certain way, and then smart persons, they invent a heresy that goes along with their misbehavior. Clever. For Manichaeus, therefore, Manichaeism, there is no what? No grace. Is that right?
Not with power.
There's no grace. Is that right? Or no freedom. Now try to remember between those two. This is the teacher in me. I told my students over the years, teaching my Jesuits, never directly give your students an answer. Make them think. So once more, the two major heresies, the last two, Pelagianism and Manichaeism, both of which were fought by St. Augustine, and the Catholic doctrine was defended. One denies human freedom, the other denies divine grace. The one that denies divine grace claims his whole human freedom. The one that denies human freedom says it's all grace. Now, with that introduction, which one is which? Please. Manichaeism denies free will and claims it is all grace. And that's why, very logically, St. Augustine was a Manichaean. A good God and a bad God. If you're under the influence of the good God, well, you're living a virtuous life. If you're under the influence of the bad God, you're living a sinful life. But don't blame yourself. Blame the God. Manichaeism is the most prevalent heresy in the modern world. Nobody blames themselves. And we've even invented the science of psychiatry. Find out, you know, why are you behaving that way? Well, it's back in your early years. It's the upbringing you had. It's your father or your mother. It's in your genes. Now, there's no doubt that our education, our ancestry, and our environment do shape or do contribute to our character. But can we have saints in the slums? Is that possible? Can we have criminals in the suburbs? Is that possible? You better believe it. At any rate, that was St. Augustine's contribution, very summarily stated, combating those three major heresies. Now the second feature of St. Augustine is deep understanding of the faith. Remember what we've said so many times. A mystery of the faith is something which, once revealed, cannot be comprehended, but it better be understood. Because comprehension is what? Comprehension means what?
Total understanding.
Total understanding. Only God fully understands the mysteries for us, which He revealed. Of course, the better a person's intellect, the stronger mind that a person has, and that person is a person of faith, that person will understand the meaning of the mysteries in a way that other people, to no fault of their own, simply cannot understand. Augustine had a superb intellect. And his mother, Monica, was praying for his conversion. She couldn't, in a vague way, anticipate how important her converted son would be for the church. He had a superb intellect. But once converted, then God used that mind to enable Augustine, and because he wrote so much to help us understand what we believe. There is no mystery of the Catholic faith. St. Augustine did explain at great length and at profound depth. There's a 500-page book just on the Trinity, De Trinitate. He has several volumes on divine grace. He has volumes on the Church. And it was he who made clear that we need divine grace to be saved, but we need to use our free will to cooperate with that grace to be saved. So it is not as though it is either all grace or all free will. It is both. Then regarding the Church's sacraments, St. Augustine explained the meaning of the sacraments. For example, what centuries later the Church came along, Council of Trent, 1,200 years later. No, 1,100 years later. Defined that the sacraments confer grace as opere operato. Meaning what? The sacraments give grace just because they are received. Just because a newborn child is baptized, water is poured on the child's head, and the words of baptism are pronounced, that baby contributes nothing, zero, to the baptism. But the effect takes place. In other words, that the sacraments produce their effect independent of the person, either who confers the sacrament or the one who receives the sacrament, provided always the minimum dispositions are present. And so on down the whole litany, depth, clarity of understanding.
Father, when someone receives communion, but they're in a state of sin, do they receive grace from that?
No, but you receive Christ. In other words, a person's being in the state of grace or in the state of sin in no way affects the real presence. That too was St. Augustine. If any person is not in the state of grace and, say, does not realize, can a person be in good faith but in the state of sin? Is that possible? Yes, it is possible. However, the understanding of the faith then comes from the intellect under divine guidance, penetrating into the meaning of what we believe. The mysteries that St. Augustine made clear way back in the late 4th century are still nourishing the faith of millions. His commentaries on sacred scripture, his treatises on the spiritual life, his homilies to the people are the most extensive of any saintly writer that we use in the Catholic Church. We're still on the importance of St. Augustine, now part 3, on the beauty of his writing. There's a difference, as we all know, between two pieces of writing. Both are correct, both make sense, and both are intelligible. But one piece of writing is more beautiful than another. St. Augustine, for years before his conversion, St. Augustine was a great rhetorician, meaning that he taught how to speak and how to write beautifully. And there's a difference between writing correctly, even writing truthfully, and writing beautifully. And as one who has been spending years in the writing trade, as I might call it, I know there's a difference between something that I write, now read it, it's correct, all right, but it should be better expressed. So I rewrite it. Then I read it again, think I can get improve. My average, when I start writing a book, to the time the book is published, is 7 times I revise my writings. And I got that from St. Augustine. In other words, there's a difference between saying, all right, 1 + 1 = 2. So what's new? Or you can express yourself in language which is not only correct, but beautiful. That was St. Augustine. He was a master rhetorician. Having taught literature for so many years, he taught in Latin. He spoke in Latin. And he thought beautifully in Latin. He was an artist in language. So that when he was converted, his writings, I repeat, are not only deep or orthodox, but they are beautiful. And part of their beauty is their clarity. You can really see what he's saying. Later on, when he grew in humility, he became self-conscious and felt guilty about trying to write really in, you might say, in beautiful language. Felt guilty for, well, you might say, using cosmetics in his writing. But he didn't have to use cosmetics. He had a beautiful style. His vocabulary, the vocabulary of St. Augustine, had become part of the church's language. And many of his statements are now proverbs of Christianity. So much for the importance of St. Augustine. Now, the historical setting in which St. Augustine lived. Because, as we know, God raises his saints at times when he, God, knows they are most needed. Augustine was raised to sanctity thanks to his mother, at a time when the church has just come out of the catacombs. and was beginning to be herself. The numbers increased. But, as Augustine already found out, not all Christians were Catholics. And therefore, God raised up St. Augustine to provide the church with the kind of mind, and then, of course, gave him the desire to write, because he could have been a great mind, but if he hadn't written, well, we could read in the books, man, strange name, was called Augustine, had a great mind, but he wouldn't have left anything. So God also inspired him to do a lot of writing, so that he would not only enlighten the people of his own day, but we can say all future generations to come. And we've talked about the three major heresies that St. Augustine combated. What we should say is that all the heresies in Christianity ever since can be traced to those three. So that in providing the church with St. Augustine, God gave us access to the writings of a man whose ideas, now centuries after he died, are the refutation of all those erroneous teachings. For example, in teaching about Protestantism, I'm telling my students that Protestantism is a combination of Manichaeism and Pelagianism. On the one hand, the Protestants pay a lot of respect to grace. Grace this and grace that. Grace is all over their writings. So then you ask, well, what's grace? Well, grace is that which God gives those people whom he has predestined to be saved. See? I mean, not everybody gets the grace. Sorry, my dear. But I cannot understand it. It's a mystery. So then, Pelagianism infected Protestantism by Pelagians. What do the Pelagians deny? To deny free will or grace? What do they deny?
Grace.
Okay, grace. That's it. Yeah. Say it with a, you know, with a rising intonation. They deny grace. And it seems to me then the Protestants were not Pelagians if they denied grace. Well, no. They were on that side. They were what? Manichaeans. Except the Manichaeans were at least honest. Those who fought Protestantism were not honest. The Manichaeans were at least, I say, honest enough, say, to say, there are two gods. The good God, he of grace, and the bad God, well, he misleads. Those people are going to go to hell. So, on its denial of free will. On its denial of free will, what is Protestantism? Pelagian or Manichaean? Let me repeat the question. On the side of his denying, because Protestantism denies free will, is it therefore Pelagian or Manichaean? Manichaean. But Protestantism so denies free will. On that side, it is, what's more? But Protestantism also denies divine grace in the sense in which divine grace has been revealed, that with which we have to cooperate. On that side, denying grace, then Protestantism is what? Pelagian. Am I making sense? And teaching the Protestants, they take furious notes. And they've never fired me from teaching at a Protestant seminary. I just tell them, look, you better know your roots. Man by the name of Pelagius, see, this is one of your roots. Man by the name of Manichaeus, one of your roots. They take notes. When I give them examination, they better know. I should say this, though. In teaching, for example, the Lutheran School of Theology for 7 years in Chicago, one of the pubs I ran into, some of my students there were not sure they should be ordained Lutheran ministers. So, well, that's your problem. But they better know the truth. Okay. So, St. Augustine, therefore, was raised by God to provide the church, and we can say until the end of time, with the most intelligent refutation of the three principal errors on which all heresies ever since have been based. Having said that, now the focus of those questions that you've got. There are 70 more coming. By the way, may I ask you, if you have copies of the Treasury of Kathy Wisdom, I included the sections from his confessions on which this present lesson is based. So read it, would you? Read, I don't have the book in front of me, but the section from the Treasury of Kathy Wisdom, taken from the Confession of St. Augustine, are all on, St. Augustine's teaching in the Confessions, which is the basis of this lesson. Okay. So we're asking, what is the focus of this lesson? What are those 100 questions mainly about? The confessions, therefore, as I said before, are one of the great books that every Catholic should read. What St. Augustine brings out in his confessions is the mercy of Christ in a sinful world. What the Savior had done during his visible stay in Palestine, this is Augustine, Christ continues doing now as a good shepherd who goes out in search of the stray sheep until he finds it. And by the way, that's our responsibility. Find stray sheep. Did I give you people an assignment yet on making converts? Well, nothing like the present. Today is August the 27th, Feast of St. Monica. whose great title of fame was that she was the mother of the scoundrel St. Augustine. Converted her husband and her son. My assignment for the next year, each one of you, and if the Lord spares me and I'm here, and he'll be meeting on August the 27th, 1992, I will ask for a report. Bring at least one person either back to the church or to the Catholic faith. Is that clear? All right, sisters? As a community, you can work together. So that means you've got at least four. What's your average in a year? Do you think you have at least four? Do you think you have at least four converts? Sure. You should start keeping a list, okay? Daniel? Carolyn? Kathleen? Okay. So, that's the main theme of the Confessions, the mercy of Christ. Now, the section from which I quote in the Confessions of St. Augustine are from the last two books of that work of Augustine. He calls them books, book 8 and 9. He would call them chapters. And they describe St. Augustine's conversion to the faith and his experience as a new Catholic. That's why I chose those passages, describing his conversion and then his experiences as a convert. In reading these books, as we call them, of the Confessions, we should look especially at how St. Augustine finally made the break with his former life of sin. What finally made him break with his life of sin? And then how a newfound faith affected his whole outlook on life. That's really what the modern world needs, and what came to me during my 9 days in Fatima. The, capital T, capital H, capital E, the conversion which the modern world needs is the conversion of those who either have never embraced the faith or abandoned the faith out of pride of their intellect. And the more educated people become, the harder it is for them to remain humble. Because they think they know it all. Consequently, look for that. And we'll finish with just those two items. On the first level, that is, what finally made him break with his former way of life? Augustine would never have broken with his sinful past except for the persuasive words and powerful example of his friends. This is awfully, and I mean awfully important. People are not converted by, some lightning bolt from heaven. On occasion, like Saul, remember, on his way to Damascus. But even there, remember, who was at the stoning of St. Stephen? Who was there? Saul. So it's the example is the persuasive words, is the practice of virtue. Augustine saw and believed. Whatever St. Augustine brings out, it is that in God's ordinary providence, God uses other human beings as the channels of His grace in our lives. In other words, Augustine was converted because God used human beings, and this is Mother Teresa's in your constitutions. She used the expression conduits. Remember in your constitution? Conduits of divine grace. That's what we're supposed to be. And what's the current running through that wire? It is divine grace from Christ through us to others. Okay. Then in describing his conversion, St. Augustine shows a close relationship between the human mind and free will. We have a free will, all right. We can choose to do good or we can choose to do evil. But unless the mind is humble enough to submit to God's revealed truth, the world is going to be enslaved by its unruly passions. Then we repeat before we close. If there's one thing that Augustine brings out, it is that no matter how good the intellect may be, how penetrating, how powerful, it will not be able to recognize the truth, which was the mind is for, unless the will submits to the will of God. Remember in the Beatitudes, blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. A person whose passions are enslaved, a person living in sin, may be a genius. The mind is dull. And that's what Augustine found out, that unless he was humble in his submitting to God's will, his mind simply would not see the truth. And with that, I think we should take a 2-week break. So, thank you. In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Amen.
Thank you.